Smithfield. Jake drove 45 minutes south, walked into the courtroom, and waited until some rather long-winded lawyers finished their bickering and His Honor had a few moments to spare. In chambers, Jake again described his client's condition, explained that Dr. Rooker felt the matter was urgent, and insisted that the kid be allowed out of the jail for an examination. He posed no safety or flight risk. Hell, he was barely capable of feeding himself. Jake finally convinced the judge that the ends of justice would be served by getting the defendant some immediate medical help. And her fee is $500, he added on his way out of the door. For a two-hour consultation? That's what she said. I promised her we, the state, because you and I are now on his payroll, right, would cover it. And that brings up the matter of my fees. We'll discuss them later, Jake. I have lawyers waiting. Thanks, Judge. I'll call Lowell and Ozzie, and they'll bitch and cuss and probably come crying to you. That's part of my job. I'm not worried about them. I'll tell Ozzie that you want him to drive the kid to Tupelo. He'll like that. Whatever. And I'm filing a motion to transfer the case to youth court. Please wait until there's an indictment. Okay. And don't waste a lot of time on the motion. Is that because you don't plan to waste a lot of time with it? That's correct, Jake. Well, thanks for the candor. As always. At 8 o'clock Thursday morning, Drew Gamble was led to a small dark room and told by the jailer that it was time for a shower. He had declined earlier requests and needed a good scrubbing. He was given a bar of soap and a towel and told to hurry. There was a 5-minute limit on showers throughout the jail, and also warned that the hot water, if any, would last for only the first 2 minutes. He closed the door, stripped, and tossed out his soiled clothing, which the jailer collected and took to the laundry. When Drew was finished, he was given the smallest orange jumpsuit available and a pair of well-used rubber shower shoes, also orange in color, and taken back to his cell, where he declined a plate of eggs and bacon. Instead, he munched on peanuts and drank a soda. As usual, he did not speak to the jailers, even when spoken to. They had at first assumed their prisoner had some serious attitude, but soon realized that his mind was functioning at a very low level. One whispered to another, "His light's barely on, but nobody's home." Jake arrived just before 9 with 2 dozen fresh donuts that he passed around the jail in an effort to score points with old friends who now viewed him as an enemy. A few were taken, but most were ignored. He left one box at the front desk and walked back to the jail. Alone with Drew in his cell, he offered his client a donut. And to his surprise, he ate 2 of them. The sugar seemed to jack up his energy, and he asked, "Is something going on today, Jake?" "Yes. You're taking a trip to Tupelo to see a doctor."
"I'm not sick, am I?"
"We'll let the doctor decide that. She'll ask you a lot of questions about yourself and your family, and where you've lived and all that. And you need to tell the truth and answer to the best of your ability."
"Is she a shrink or something?"
The use of the word shrink caught Jake off guard. "She's a psychiatrist."
"Oh, a shrink. I've met one or two before."
"Really? Where?"
"They put me in jail one time, in the juvenile pen, and I had to see a shrink once a week. It was a waste of time."
"But I've asked you twice if you've ever been to juvenile court, and you said no."
"I don't remember you asking me that. Sorry."
"Why were you in the juvenile pen?" Drew took another bite of a donut and thought about the question.
"And you're my lawyer, right?"
"This is the 5th straight day I've come here to the jail to talk to you. Only your lawyer would do that, right?"
"I really want to see my mom."
Jake breathed deeply and told himself to be patient, something he did with every visit. "Your mother had surgery yesterday. They reset her jaw, and she's doing fine. You can't see her now, but I'm sure they'll allow her to come here for a visit.
I thought she was dead.
I know you did, Drew. Jake heard voices in the hall and looked at his watch. Here's the drill. The sheriff will drive you to Tupelo. You'll sit in the back seat, probably alone, and you are not to say a word to anyone else in the car. Understand?
You're not going?
I'll be in my car behind you, and I'll be there when you meet the doctor. Just don't say anything to the sheriff or his deputies, okay?
Will they talk to me?
I doubt it. The door opened and Ozzie barged in with Moss Jr. behind him. Jake stood and offered a terse, "Morning, gentlemen." But they only nodded. Moss Jr. unsnapped the cuffs from his belt and said to Drew, "Stand up, please." Jake asked, "Does he have to wear handcuffs? I mean, he's not going anywhere." "We know our job, Jake. Same as you," Ozzie said like a real smartass. "Why can't he wear street clothes? Look, Ozzie, he's going for a psychiatric evaluation, and sitting there in an orange jumpsuit will not help matters." "Back off, Jake." "I'm not backing off. I'll call Judge Noose." "You do that." The jailer said, "He doesn't have any extra clothes, just one change, and it's in the laundry." Jake looked at the jailer and asked, "You don't allow the kids to have any clothes?" Ozzie said, "He's not a kid, Jake. He was in circuit court last time I checked." To benefit nothing, Moss Jr. said, "They burned all his clothes, same for his mother and sister." Drew shuddered and took a deep breath. Jake looked at Drew, then looked at Moss Jr. and asked, "Was that really necessary?"
"You're asking about more clothes. Ain't got 'em."
Ozzie said, "Let's go." Every office had leaks, and Ozzie had been burned on occasion. The last thing he wanted was a front-page photo of him trying to sneak the accused killer out for a visit to a psychiatrist. His car was waiting behind the jail, with Looney and Swayze standing guard and prepared to shoot any reporter they saw. The getaway went smoothly, and as Jake raced to keep up with them in his Saab, he could barely see the top of Drew's blonde hair in the rear seat. Dr. Rooker's office was one of a dozen in a professional office building not far from downtown Tupelo. As directed, Ozzie turned into a service drive behind the building and was met by two marked patrol cars from the Lee County Sheriff's Department. He parked, got out, left Moss Jr. in the front seat to guard the defendant, and went inside with the local deputies to check out the premises. Jake remained in his car, not far from Ozzie's, and waited. What else could he do? Driving over, he had called Portia, who had called the hospital for information about Josie Gamble. Portia had learned nothing and was waiting for a return call from a nurse. Half an hour dragged by. Moss Jr. finally got out and lit a cigarette, and Jake walked over for a chat. He glanced into the rear seat and saw Drew lying down with his knees pulled to his chest. Jake nodded at him and asked, "Did he say much?"
"Not a word. Nothing. Course, we didn't pry. That's a sick puppy, Jake."
"What do you mean?"
"Have you heard that humming sound he does? Just sits there with his eyes closed and sort of hums and groans at the same time, like he's in another world."
"I've heard it." Moss blew a cloud of smoke at the sky and shifted weight from his right foot to his left.
"Can he get off 'cause he's crazy, Jake?"
"So that's what's going around."
"Oh, yeah. Folks think you'll get him off like you did Carl Lee by saying he's insane."
"Well, folks have to say something, don't they, Moss?"
"That they do, yes. But that ain't right, Jake."
He cleared his throat and spat near the bumper as if disgusted.
"Folks are gonna be upset, Jake. And I hate to see you take the blame."
"I'm just a temp, Moss. Noose has promised to find somebody else if it goes all the way to a trial."
"Is that where it's going?"
"Don't know. I'm pinch hitting till there's an indictment and something gets put on a calendar. Then I'll bail."
That's good to hear. This might get nasty before it's over.
It's already nasty. Ozzy was back with the other deputies. He spoke to Moss Jr., who opened a rear door and asked Drew to step out. They quickly escorted him inside the building, and Jake followed along. In a small conference room, Dr. Rooker was waiting and introduced herself to Jake. They had spoken on the phone several times, and the introduction was brief. She was tall and slender, with bright red hair that was probably not natural, and she wore funky reading glasses of many colors that were perched on the tip of her nose. She was about 50, older than any of the men, and thoroughly unintimidated by any of them. This was her office, her show. Once Ozzy felt the defendant was secure, he excused himself and said he and Moss Jr. would be waiting down the hall. It was clear that Dr. Rooker did not like the idea of armed men waiting in her quiet little office suite, but under the circumstances, she went along. It was not every day that she talked to a man or a kid who was charged with capital murder. Drew looked even smaller in the oversized jumpsuit. The rubber shower shoes looked ridiculous and were several sizes too large. They barely touched the floor as he sat with his hands folded in his lap, chin down, eyes on the floor, as if too frightened to acknowledge those around him. Jake said, "Drew, this is Dr. Rooker, and she is here to help you." With effort, he nodded at her, then looked back at the floor. Jake said, "I'll be here for just a moment, then I'll disappear. I'm going to ask you to listen to her carefully and answer her questions. She's on our side, Drew. Do you understand?" He nodded and slowly lifted his eyes to the wall above Jake's head, as if he heard something up there and didn't like it. A slow, mournful groan came out, but he said nothing. As frightening as it was, Jake wanted the kid to start his incessant humming again. Dr. Rooker needed to hear it and evaluate it, if that was possible.
"How old are you, Drew?" she asked.
16.
"And when was your birthday?"
"February 10th.
"So last month. Did you have a party on your birthday?"
"No."
"Did you have birthday cake?"
"No."
"Did your friends at school know it was your birthday?"
"Don't think so."
"Who is your mother?"
"Josie."
"And you have a sister, right?"
"Right. Kira."
"And there's nobody else in your family?"
He shook his head.
"No grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins?"
He kept shaking his head.
"How about your father?"
His eyes were suddenly wet, and he wiped them on an orange sleeve.
"Don't know him."
"Have you ever known your father?"
He shook his head. She estimated his height at 5 feet and his weight at 100 pounds. There was no visible muscle development. His voice was high, soft, still childlike. There was no facial hair, no acne, nothing to indicate that the middle stages of puberty had arrived. He closed his eyes again and began rocking slightly, leaning forward from the waist, then easing back. She touched his knee and asked,
"Drew, are you afraid of something right now?"
He began to hum in that same steady emission that at times sounded more like a soft growl. They listened to him for a moment, exchanged glances, and then she asked,
"Drew, why do you make that noise?"
The only response was more of the same. She withdrew her hand, glanced at her watch, and relaxed as if they might be a while. A minute passed, then two. After 5, she nodded at Jake, and he quietly left the room. The hospital was not far away. Jake found Ms. Gamble in a second-floor semi-private room shared with what appeared to be a corpse, but was, as it turned out, a 96-year-old man who had just received a new kidney. At 96? Kira had secured a small fold-out bed, and it was tucked next to her mother's. They had been there for 2 nights and would be leaving in the afternoon. Where they were headed was still undecided. Josie looked awful with a swollen and bruised face, but she was in good spirits and claimed to be free of pain. The surgery had gone well. All the bones were accounted for and rearranged, and she didn't have to see a doctor for a week. Jake settled into a chair at the foot of her bed and asked if they wanted to talk. What else did they have to do until discharged? A friendly nurse brought him a cup of hospital coffee and pulled the curtain so the corpse couldn't hear them. They spoke in low voices, and Jake explained where Drew was and what was happening. For a moment, Josie was hopeful she might be able to see him since he was just around the corner, but realized neither was in any condition for a visit. The sheriff wouldn't allow it, and Drew was headed back to jail in short order. Jake said, "I'm not sure how long I'll be your lawyer. As I explained, the judge gave me a temporary appointment to handle the preliminary matters, and he plans to find someone else later."
"Why can't you be a lawyer?"
Josie asked. Her words were slow and difficult, but clear enough for a conversation. "I am, for now. We'll see what happens later." Kira, who was shy and had trouble keeping eye contact, said,
"Mr. Callison from our church said you're the best lawyer in the county. Said we're lucky to have you."
Jake had not expected to be backed into a corner by his clients and forced to explain why he didn't want them. He certainly couldn't and wouldn't admit that Drew's case was so toxic he was worried about his own reputation. In all likelihood, he would live in Clanton for the rest of his life and try to make a decent living. The Gambles would probably be gone in a few months. But how could he explain this to two people staying in a hospital with no home, no clothing, no money, and the frightening prospect of their son and brother facing the death penalty? At the moment, he was their only protection. The church folks could provide food and comfort, but that was temporary. He tried to duck with, "Well, Mr. Callison is a very nice man, but there are a lot of good lawyers around here. The judge will probably pick someone with experience in juvenile matters." Jake felt guilty at his own bullshit. It wasn't a juvenile matter, and would never become one. And there were only a handful of lawyers in North Mississippi with capital trial experience. And Jake knew damned well that all of them would be hiding from their telephones in the days to come. No one wanted a dead cop case in a small town. Harry Rex was right. The case had already become a liability and would only get worse. Armed with a yellow legal pad, Jake managed to steer the conversation away from his representation and into the family's history. Without asking about Josie's past, he pried into their other addresses, other homes, other towns. How did they end up in rural Ford County? Where had they lived before and before that? At times, Kira remembered details, and at other times, she drifted away and seemed to lose interest. One moment she was engaged, the next she was frightened and withdrawn. She was a pretty girl, tall for her age, with deep brown eyes and long dark hair. She looked nothing like her brother, and no one would have guessed that she was 2 years younger. The more Jake probed, the more he became convinced that she, too, had been traumatized. Perhaps not by Stuart Kofer, but by other people who had had the opportunity over the years. She had lived with relatives, in 2 foster homes, in an orphanage, in a camper, under an overpass, in a homeless shelter. The deeper he dug, the sadder their story became. And after an hour, he'd had enough. He said goodbye with the promise to check on Drew and to see them again as soon as possible. Chapter 13. Thursday lunch met a quick visit to the school's cafeteria, where parents were invited to grab a tray and for $2 dine on either grilled chicken tenders or spaghetti and meatballs. It was not one of Jake's favorite meals of the week, but food was not important since he got to sit with Hannah and a gaggle of her fourth-grade girlfriends. As the weeks passed, and as they grew, he was dismayed to learn that they spent more time talking about boys. He was scheming of ways to put a stop to it, but so far had thought of nothing. Carla usually dropped by for a quick chat, but her sixth graders were on a different schedule. Mandy Baker's mother, Helen, was an occasional guest, and Jake knew the family, though they would never be close. They sat across from each other on the low stools and listened with amusement as the girls all talked at once. After a few moments, the girls forgot their parents were there and ramped up the chatter. When they were thoroughly preoccupied, Helen said,
"I just can't believe that about Stuart Kofer. Can you?"
"Such a tragedy," Jake said as he chewed on some chicken. Helen's husband's family owned a string of self-service gas stations and were rumored to be doing well. They lived at the country club, and Jake avoided most of the people out there. They put on airs and enjoyed looking down, and he had no patience with them. Helen did the lunch once a month, and Jake assumed she had chosen this day to say what she was about to say. So, when she said it, he was prepared. Leaning in a bit lower, she said,
"I can't believe you would represent a killer like that, Jake. I thought you were one of us."
Or he thought he was prepared. The one of us caught him off guard and instantly brought to mind several stinging and snappy retorts that would only make things worse. He let them pass and said, "Gotta have a lawyer, Helen. You can't put the boy in the gas chamber if he doesn't have a lawyer. Surely you understand that."
"Oh, I guess. But there are so many lawyers around here. Why do you have to get involved?"
"Who would you choose, Helen?"
"Oh, I don't know. What about some of those ACLU types in Memphis or even down in Jackson? You know, the real bleeding hearts. I can't imagine doing that for a living, representing killers and child rapists and such."
"How often do you read the Constitution?" he asked, a bit sharper than he had intended.
"Oh, come on, Jake. Don't give me all that legal mess."
"No, Helen. The Constitution, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, says that a person accused of a serious crime must have a lawyer. And that's the law of the land."
"I suppose. I just don't understand why you're involved."
Jake bit his tongue to keep from reminding her that neither she nor her husband nor anyone in their families had ever sought his advice or legal services. Why, then, was she now so concerned about his practice? She was just a gossip, who could now boast to her friends that she had bumped into Jake Brigance and dressed him down in public for representing such a despicable killer. She would no doubt expand the story, launch on it for the next month, and gain the admiration of her friends. Thankfully, Carla appeared and eased into the child's chair next to Jake. She greeted Helen warmly and asked how her Aunt Una was doing since her fall. The murder was instantly forgotten as the conversation moved to the upcoming fourth-grade talent show. With her jaws wired together, Josie found it impossible to chew food, so her last lunch at the hospital was another chocolate milkshake through a straw, after which she was required to sit in a wheelchair as they rolled her out of the room and down the hallway. Eventually, she and Kira and two orderlies exited through the front door and got into the car of Mrs. Carol Huff, who had volunteered to do the driving because she owned a four-door Pontiac. Pastor Charles McGarry and his wife Meg were there for the release, and they followed Mrs. Huff in their little import out of Tupelo and back to Ford County. The Good Shepherd Bible Church had a narrow sanctuary that was pretty and timeless. Years after it was built, one of the many congregations added a two-story wing across the back. a less-than-handsome annex with classrooms for Sunday school upstairs and a small fellowship hall and kitchen on the first floor, next to the office where Pastor McGarry prepared his sermons and counseled his flock. He had decided that the church would offer the use of a classroom to Josie and Kira as a short-term apartment, with access to the downstairs toilet and the kitchen. He and the deacons had met three times in extra sessions since Monday to try to find a place for the family, and a classroom in the back of the church was the best they could do. One member owned a rental home that might be available in a month or so, but that member also relied upon the income from it. A farmer had a barn/guest house, but it needed some work. There was the offer of a camper, but McGarry waved it off. Josie and the kids had recently survived a year in one. The church had no wealthy people, the type who owned multiple homes. Its members were retirees, small farmers, middle-class working folks who were doing well to scrape by themselves. Other than love and warm food, they had little to offer. Josie and Kira had no other place to go and no family to turn to. Leaving the area was out of the question because of Drew and his problems. Josie did not have a bank account and had been surviving on limited cash for several years. Kofor had demanded $200 a month for rent and food, and she had always been in arrears. The original arrangement had been based on plenty of sex and companionship in exchange for food and shelter, but the intimacy had not lasted long. She had no credit cards and no credit history. Her last paycheck from the car wash was for $51, and a convenience store owed her $40 more. She was not sure how to collect and not even sure if she still had the job there, though she was assuming the worst. At least two of her three part-time jobs were gone, and her doctor said she could not look for work for at least 2 weeks. There were relatives in South Mississippi and Louisiana, but they had stopped taking her calls years earlier. Charles showed them to their new quarters. The air was thick with the smell of freshly cut wood and new paint. Shelving had been installed above the bunk beds, and a portable television was on a bottom shelf. There was a rug on the floor and a fan in the window. The closet was filled with hand-me-down shirts, pants, jeans, blouses, and two jackets that the church had collected, cleaned, and pressed. There was a small refrigerator already stocked with cold water and fruit juice. In a cheap chest of drawers, there were new undergarments, socks, t-shirts, and pajamas. Downstairs in the kitchen, Mrs. Huff showed them the larger refrigerator, filled with food and bottles of water and tea, all at their disposal. She showed them the coffee pot and filters. Charles gave Josie a key to the rear doors and invited her and Kira to try to make themselves at home. The deacons had decided that two or three men would make the rounds each night and make sure they were safe. The ladies had put together a meal schedule for the next week. A retired schoolteacher named Mrs. Golden had volunteered to tutor Kira in the church several hours a day until she caught up and until they, whoever they might be, made the decision about her returning to school. Half the deacons thought she should return to the junior high in Clanton. The other half believed that would be too traumatic and that she should be homeschooled in the church. Josie had not yet been consulted. Mrs. Golden used her contacts at the school to obtain a set of replacement textbooks for Kira. The others had either been burned by Earl Kofor, as he claimed, or they were in the house and could not be retrieved. New ones would be required. Kira was in the 8th grade, a year behind where she should be, and was still struggling to keep up with her classmates. Her teachers considered her bright, but with her chaotic family and unstable past, she had missed too many days of school. Drew was in the 9th grade, 2 years behind, and not gaining momentum. He loathed being the oldest kid in his class and often refused to reveal his real age. He didn't realize his luck in arriving late to puberty and looking no older than the other boys. Mrs. Golden had gone to the high school and talked to the principal about Drew's academic quandary. Obviously, he couldn't take classes from the jail, nor did the school have a tutor on its payroll. Any efforts to intervene would take a court order. They decided to let the lawyers worry about that. Mrs. Golden did notice the principal's reluctance in doing anything that might help the defendant. As they were leaving the church, Charles and Meg promised to pick up Josie and Kira at 9 the following morning for the trip to town. They needed to fetch their car, and they were desperate to see Drew. Josie and Kira thanked everyone profusely and said goodbye. They walked to a picnic table next to the cemetery and sat on it. Once again, their little family was separated and one step away from being homeless. But for the goodness of others, they would be hungry and sleeping in the car. Jake was sitting at his desk, staring at a stack of pink phone messages that Portia and Bev had taken that morning. So far that week, he had spent about 18 hours working on behalf of Drew Gamble. He rarely billed by the hour because his clients were working people and indigent defendants who couldn't pay, whatever the bill. But he, like almost all lawyers, had learned the necessity of tracking his time. Not long after Jake began to work for Lucian, a lawyer across the square, a likable guy named Max Stafford, represented a teenager who had been injured in an auto accident. The case wasn't complicated, and Mac didn't bother recording his hours since his contract gave him a contingency of 1/3. The insurance company agreed to settle for $120,000, and Mac was all set to walk off with a fee of $40,000, a rarity not only in Ford County, but anywhere throughout the rural South. However, since the client was a minor, the settlement had to be approved by the Chancery Court. Chancellor Reuben Attlee asked Mac in open court to justify such a generous fee for a rather straightforward case. Mac did not have a record of his hours and failed miserably in convincing the judge that he deserved the money. They haggled for a while, and Attlee finally gave Mac a week to reconstruct his timesheets and submit them. By then, though, he was suspicious of the lawyer. Mac claimed he charged clients $100 an hour and that he had invested 400 hours in the case. Both numbers were on the high side. Attlee cut them both in half and awarded Mac $20,000. He was so incensed, he appealed to the state Supreme Court and lost 9-0 because the court had ruled for decades that sitting chancellors have unfettered discretion in just about everything. Mac finally took the money and never spoke to Judge Attlee again. 5 years later, in perhaps the most legendary act of criminal and ethical misconduct by a member of the local bar, Mac stole $500,000 from 4 clients and skipped town. To Jake's knowledge, not a single person, including Mac's ex-wife and 2 daughters, had ever heard a word from him. On really bad days, Jake, as well as most lawyers in town, dreamed of being Mac and roasting on a beach somewhere with a cold drink. At any rate, the local bar swallowed the lesson whole, and most lawyers kept up with their hours. In the Smallwood lawsuit, Jake had worked over 1,000 hours in the 14 months since Harry Rex landed the case and associated him. That was almost half his time, and he anticipated being well compensated for it. Drew's case, though, could possibly eat up huge chunks of time with little in the way of fees. Another reason to get rid of it. The phone rang again, and Jake waited for someone else to answer it. It was almost 5 p.m., and for a moment he thought of joining Lucian downstairs for a drink, but let it pass. Carla frowned on drinking, especially on weekdays. So his thoughts moved from hard alcohol back to Max Stafford sipping rum drinks, studying bikinis, far away from bitching clients and cranky judges, and, oh well, there you go again. Through the intercom, Portia said, "Hey, Jake, it's Dr. Rooker in Tupelo." "Thanks." Jake tossed the phone slips onto his desk and picked up the receiver. "Hello, Dr. Rooker. Thanks again for seeing Drew today."
"It's my job, Mr. Brigance. Are you near your fax machine?"
"I can be."
"Good. I'm sending over a letter I've addressed to Judge Noose and copies to you. Give it a look, and if you agree, I'll send it to him in a moment."
"Sounds urgent."
"In my opinion, it is."
Jake hustled downstairs and found Portia standing at the fax machine. The letter read,
"To the Honorable Omar Noose, Circuit Court, 22nd Judicial District. Dear Judge Noose, at the request of Mr. Jake Brigance, this afternoon I met and examined Drew Allen Gamble, age 16. He was brought to my office in Tupelo, in handcuffs and wearing what appeared to be a standard orange jumpsuit issued by the Ford County Jail. In other words, he was not properly clothed, and this was not an ideal way to begin a consultation. Everything I witnessed when he arrived suggested to me that the child is being treated like an adult and is presumed to be guilty. I observed a teenaged boy who is frightfully small for his age and could easily pass for a child several years younger. I did not, nor was I expected to, examine him physically, but I saw no signs of stage 3 or stage 4 pubescent developments. I observed the following, all of which are highly unusual for a 16-year-old. 1. Little growth and no muscular development. 2. No sign of any facial hair. 3. No sign of acne. 4. A childlike voice with no deepening. For the first hour of our 2-hour visit, Drew was uncooperative and said little. Mr. Brigance had briefed me on some of his background, and using this, I was finally able to engage Drew in conversation that can only be described as intermittent and strained. He was unable to grasp even the simplest concepts, such as being placed in jail and not being able to leave whenever he wants. He says that at times he remembers events. At times, he forgets those same happenings. He asked me at least 3 times if Stuart Kofer was really dead, but I did not answer him. He became irritable and on 2 occasions told, not asked, me to shut up. He was never aggressive or angry and often cried when he couldn't answer a question. Twice, he said he wished he could die and admits that he often thinks of suicide. I learned that Drew and his sister have been neglected, physically abused, psychologically abused, and subjected to domestic violence. I cannot say and do not know all of the people responsible for this. He was simply not that forthcoming. I strongly suspect there has been a lot of abuse, and Drew, and more than likely his sister too, has suffered at the hands of several people. The sudden and/or violent loss of a loved one can trigger traumatic stress in children. Drew and his sister had been abused by Mr. Kofer. They thought, with good reason, that he had killed their mother and that he was about to harm them again. This is more than sufficient to trigger traumatic stress. Trauma in children can bring about a variety of responses, including wide swings in emotions, bouts of depression, anxiety, fear, inability to eat or sleep, nightmares, slow academic progress, and many other problems, which I will detail in my full report. If left untreated, Drew will only regress and the damage can become permanent. The last place for him right now is a jail built for adults. I strongly recommend that Drew be sent immediately
to the state mental hospital at Whitfield, where there is a secure facility for juveniles, for a thorough examination and long-term treatment. I will finish my report and fax it to you in the morning. Respectfully, Dr. Christina A. Rooker, M.D., Tupelo, Mississippi. An hour later, Jake was still at his desk, ignoring the phone and wanting to go home. Portia, Lucian, and part-time Bev had already left. He heard the familiar rattle of the fax machine downstairs, and glancing at his watch, wondered who was still working at 5 minutes after six on a Thursday evening. He grabbed his jacket and briefcase, turned off his light, and went down to the fax machine. It was a single sheet of paper with the official heading, Circuit Court of Ford County, Mississippi. Just under was the style of the case, State of Mississippi versus Drew Allen Gamble. There was no file number because there had been no official appearance by the defendant and no indictment. Someone, probably Judge Noose himself, had typed, "The court does hereby direct the sheriff of Ford County to transport the above-named defendant to the state mental hospital with all possible speed, preferably on Friday, March 30th, 1990, and there to surrender his person to Mr. Rupert Easley, Director of Security, until further orders of this court." So ordered, signed Judge Omar Noose. Jake smiled at the outcome and placed the order on Portia's desk. He had done his job and protected the best interests of his client. He could almost hear the courthouse gossip, the rumblings at the coffee shops, the cursing among the deputies. He told himself he didn't care anymore. Chapter 14. The weather was perfect for a funeral, though the setting left something to be desired. On Saturday, the last day of March, the sky was dark and threatening, the wind cold and biting. A week earlier, on the last day of his life, Stuart Cover had gone fishing with friends on the lake on a beautiful warm afternoon. They wore t-shirts and shorts and drank cold beer in the sunshine, as if summer had arrived early. But so much had changed, and now, on the day of his burial, raw winds swept across the land and added more gloom. The service was at the National Guard Armory, a bland and sterile 1950s-style block building designed for troop gatherings and community events, but not for funerals. It could hold 300, and the family was expecting a crowd. Though unchurched, the Cofers had lived in the county for 100 years and knew a lot of people. Stu was a popular cop with friends, acquaintances, and colleagues with families. All funerals were open to the public, and tragic deaths always attracted the curious who had little else to do and wanted to get close to the story. At 1 p.m., an hour before the service, the first news van arrived and was ordered to park in a reserved area. Uniformed officers were everywhere, waiting for the crowd, the press, the pomp and ceremony. The front doors of the armory opened, and the parking lot began to fill. Another news van arrived and began filming. Some reporters with cameras were allowed to congregate near the flagpole. Inside, 300 rented chairs had been neatly arranged in a half moon around a temporary stage and podium. The wall behind it was layered with dozens of flower arrangements, and more lined the walls. A large color photo of Stuart Cofer stood on a tripod to one side. By 1:30, the meeting hall was almost full, and a few ladies were already sobbing. In the place of proper hymns favored by real Christians, someone within the family had selected a playlist of sad tunes by some country crooner, and his mournful braying echoed from a set of cheap speakers. Fortunately, the volume was not high, but it was still loud enough to add to the somber mood. The crowd filed in, and before long, all chairs were taken. Additional mourners were asked to stand against the walls. By 1:45, There was no more space, and those trying to get in were told the service would be broadcast outside over a PA system. The family gathered in a small office wing and waited for the hearse from McGargle Funeral Home, the last remaining mortuary for white people in Ford County. There were two for the blacks who were buried in their cemeteries. The whites were buried in theirs, and even in 1990, the graveyards were tightly segregated. No one had been put to rest out of place. Because it was a big funeral, with a crowd and the chance of cameras, Mr. McGargle had leaned on friends in the business and borrowed some nicer cars. When he pulled his sleek black hearse into the drive beside the armory, there were six identical black sedans behind him. They were empty for the moment and parked in a neat row behind the building. Mr. McGargle hopped out, as did his squad of men in somber suits, and began directing things. He opened the rear door of the hearse and called for the eight pallbearers to come forward. Slowly they pulled the casket out and placed it on a gurney draped in velvet cloth. The family came out of the small office and stood behind the pallbearers. With McGargle leading the way, the small parade turned alongside the building and headed for the front, where an impressive battalion of uniformed men awaited them. Ozzie had worked the phones all week, and his requests had been met in fine fashion. Troops from a dozen counties, along with the state police and municipal officers from several cities, stood in formation as the casket rolled by. Cameras clicked and could be heard above the silence. Harry Rex was in the crowd outside. He would later describe the scene to Jake by saying,
"Hell, you'd have thought Kofa got killed in the line of duty, fighting crime like a real cop, not passed out drunk after he beat his girlfriend."
The throng parted as the pallbearers guided the casket through the front doors, into the armory, and across the small lobby. As it entered the center aisle, the pastor stood at the podium and said at full volume, "Please rise." The crowd rose noisily, but then fell deathly silent as the casket inched down the aisle, with Earl and Janet Kofer in step behind it. About 40 family members followed them. They had feuded for a week over the issue of a closed casket. It was not unusual to open the casket during a funeral service so that the loved ones and friends and other mourners could glimpse a profile of the deceased. This made the situation far more dramatic and maximized the grief, which of course was the purpose, though no one would ever admit it. Rural preachers preferred open caskets because they made it easier to whip up emotions and make folks worry more about their sins and their own deaths. It was not uncommon to include a few remarks directed at the deceased, as if he or she might just rise up and yell, "Repent!" Earl had lost his parents and a brother, and their services had been open, though the presiding ministers hardly knew them. But Janet Kofer knew the service would be thoroughly gut-wrenching without actually looking at her dead son. In the end, she prevailed, and the casket remained closed. When the casket was in place, a large American flag was unfolded and draped over it. Later, Harry Rex would say to Jake,
"Some bitch got kicked out of the army, and they carried on like it was full honors."
As the family shuffled into place in the front rows, reserved with McGargle's monogrammed velvet roping, the preacher motioned for the crowd to sit and nodded to a dude with a guitar. Wearing a burgundy suit, black cowboy hat, and matching boots, he walked to a floor mic, strummed a few chords, and waited for everyone to be seated. When things were still, he began singing the first stanza of "The Old Rugged Cross." He had a pleasant baritone and was deft with his guitar. He had once played in a bluegrass band with Cecil Kofer, though he had never met his deceased brother. It was unlikely Stuart Kofer had ever heard the old gospel standard. Most of his grieving family members had not. But it was appropriate for the sad occasion and succeeded in heightening the emotions. When he finished the third stanza, he gave a quick nod and returned to his seat. The family had met the minister 2 days earlier. One of their more difficult chores during that awful week had been to locate a man of God willing to conduct the service for complete strangers. There were several country preachers who had tried to reach the Kofers over the years, but all said no to the service. As a group, they were turned off by the hypocrisy of getting involved with people who had no use for any church. Finally, a cousin bribed an unemployed Pentecostal lay preacher with $300 to be the man of the hour. His name was Hubert Wyfong, and he was from Smithfield, down in Polk County. Reverend Wyfong needed the cash, but he also saw the opportunity to perform in front of a large crowd. Perhaps he could impress someone who knew a church that was looking for a part-time preacher. He offered a long, flowery prayer, then nodded at a pretty teenaged girl who stepped to the mic with her Bible and read the 23rd Psalm. Ozzie sat next to his wife and listened and marveled at the difference between white funerals and black ones. He and his force and their spouses sat together in three rows to the left of the family, all in their finest matching uniforms, all boots spit-shined, all badges gleaming. The section behind them was packed with officers from North Mississippi, all white men. Counting Willie Hastings, Scooter Gifford, Elton Fry, Parnell Johnson, and himself, along with their wives, there were exactly 10 black faces in the crowd. And Ozzie knew full well that they were welcome only because of his position. Wyfong said another prayer, a shorter one, and sat down as Stuart's 12-year-old cousin walked nervously to the mic, holding a sheet of paper. He adjusted the mic, looked fearfully at the crowd, and began reciting a poem he had written about fishing with his favorite Uncle Stew. Ozzie listened for a moment, then began to drift. The day before he had driven Drew 3 hours south to Whitfield, the state mental hospital, and turned him over to the authorities there. By the time he returned to his office, the news was raging around the county. The kid was already out of jail and was pretending to be crazy. Jake Brigance was pulling another fast one, just like he did 5 years earlier when he convinced a jury that Carl Lee Haley was temporarily insane. Haley killed 2 men in cold blood, in the courthouse even, and walked. Walked free as a bird. Late Friday afternoon, Earl Kofer drove to the jail and confronted Ozzie, who showed him a copy of the court order signed by Judge Noose. Kofer left, cursing and vowing to get even. At the moment, the crowd was mourning a tragic death, but many of those seated around him were seething with anger. The young poet had some talent and managed to get a laugh. His refrain was, "But not with Uncle Stew. But not with Uncle Stew." When he finally finished, he broke down and walked away bawling. This was contagious, and others sobbed. Wyfong rose with his Bible and began his sermon. He read from the book of Psalms and spoke of God's comforting words in a time of death. Ozzie listened for a moment with interest, then began to drift again. He had called Jake early in the morning to pass along the latest about the funeral and give him a heads up that the Kofers and their friends were upset. Jake said he had already talked to Harry Rex, who had called late Friday night and said the gossip was wild. Ozzie would admit only to himself and to his wife that the boy was in bad shape. During the long drive to Whitfield, he had not said a word to either Ozzie or Moss Jr. They initially tried to engage him in small talk, but he said nothing. He didn't rudely ignore them. Their words just didn't register. With his hands cuffed in front of him, Drew was able to lie down and pull his knees to his chest. And he started that damned humming. For over 2 hours, he hummed and groaned and at times seemed to hiss. "You okay back there?" Moss Jr. had asked when he got louder. He quieted down, but did not respond. Driving back to Clanton without him, Moss Jr. thought it would be funny to mimic the kid, and he started humming too. Ozzie told him to stop, or he'd turn around and take him to Whitfield. It was good for a laugh, which they needed. Earl Cofer's only request to the preacher was to keep it short, and Wyfong complied with a 15-minute sermon that was remarkably short on emotion and long on comfort. He finished with another prayer, then nodded at the singer for a final song. It was a secular number about a lonesome cowboy, and it worked. Women were bawling again, and it was time to go. The pallbearers took their positions around the casket, and "You'll Never Walk Alone" began to play softly over the speakers. The family followed the casket down the aisle, with Earl holding Janet steady as she wept. The procession moved slowly as someone turned up the volume. Outside, two lines of uniformed men led to the hearse with its rear door open and waiting. The pallbearers lifted the casket and carefully placed it inside. McGargle and his men directed the family to the waiting sedans. A parade formed behind them, and when everyone was in place, the hearse inched away, followed by the family, followed by rows of officers on foot, with the Ford County contingent leading. Any and all friends, relatives, and strangers who wanted to make the trek to the cemetery fell in behind. The procession moved slowly away from the armory and down Wilson Street, where barricades were in place, and children stood silently by them. Townsfolk gathered on sidewalks and watched from porches and paid their respects to the fallen hero. Jake hated funerals and avoided them whenever possible. He viewed them as a serious waste of time, money, and especially emotion. Nothing was gained by having a funeral, only the satisfaction of showing up and being seen by the grieving family. And what was the benefit of that? After being shot at during the Haley trial, he had prepared himself a new will and left written instructions to be cremated as soon as possible and buried in his hometown of Caraway with only his family present. This was a radical idea for Ford County, and Carla didn't like it. She rather enjoyed the social aspects of a good funeral. Saturday afternoon, he left his office, drove across town, and parked behind a city rec center. He walked along a nature path, climbed a small hill, and veered down a gravel trail to a clearing where he sat at a picnic table with a view of the cemetery. Hidden among the trees, he watched the hearse stop in a sea of aging tombstones. The crowd worked its way to a bright purple burial tent with McGargle's logo embroidered in bold yellow. The pallbearers labored with the casket for at least 100 feet. And were followed by the family. Jake was reminded of a well-known story of a lawyer down in Jackson who stole some client's money, faked his own death, and watched his own funeral while sitting in a tree. After he was caught and hauled back to Jackson, he refused to speak to friends who did not attend his funeral and burial. How angry was the mob down there? At the moment, the prevailing emotion was one of great sorrow, but would that quickly yield to resentment? Harry Rex, who apparently had decided to skip the burial, was convinced that Jake had thoroughly screwed up their chances with Smallwood. Jake had just become the most despised lawyer in the county, and the railroad and its insurance company would probably pull back from any settlement negotiations. And what about selecting a jury now? Any pool of prospective jurors would surely have people who knew of his representation of Drew Gamble. He was too far away to hear the words or music at the burial. After a few minutes, he left and walked back to his car. Late in the afternoon, Family and friends gathered at the large metal building that housed the Pine Grove Volunteer Fire Company. No proper send-off was complete without a heavy meal, and the ladies of the community brought in platters of fried chicken, bowls of potato salad and slaw, trays of sandwiches and corn on the cob, casseroles of all varieties, and cakes and pies. The Cofer family stood at one end of the room in a receiving line and suffered through lengthy condolences from their friends. Pastor Weifong was thanked and congratulated on such a fine service, and the young nephew received kind words about his poem. The cowboy brought his guitar and sang a few songs as the crowd filled their plates and dined at folding tables and chairs. Earl stepped outside for a smoke and gathered with some friends near a fire truck. One man pulled out a pint of whiskey and passed it around. Half declined, half took a swig. Earl and Cecil passed. A cousin said,
"That sumbitch can't claim to be crazy, can he?"
"Already done it," Earl said. "They took him to Whitfield yesterday. Ozzy drove him down."
"He had to, didn't he?"
"I don't trust him."
"Ozzy's on our side this time."
"Somebody said the judge ordered the boy taken away."
"He did," Earl said. "I saw the court order."
"Damn lawyers and judges."
"It ain't right, I'm telling you.
A lawyer told me they'll keep him locked up till he's 18, then turn him loose."
"Turn him loose then. We can take care of him.
You can't trust brigands."
"Will they even put him on trial?"
"Not if he's crazy. That's what the lawyer said. The system sucks, you know. It ain't right."
"Can anybody talk to brigands?"
"Of course not. He'll fight like hell for the boy."
"That's what lawyers do. The system is designed to protect the criminal these days. Brigands will get him off on one of those technicalities you hear about.
If I saw that sumbitch on the street, I'd kick his ass." "All I want is justice," Earl said. "And we ain't gonna get it. Brigands will plead insanity, and the boy will walk just like Carl Lee Haley."
"It ain't right, I'm telling you. It just ain't right."
Chapter 15. Lowell Dyer was hearing the noise from down the road in Ford County. He took 3 calls at home Sunday afternoon, all from strangers who claimed they voted for him, and listened to their complaints about what was happening in the Gamble case. After the 3rd, he unplugged his phone. The one at the office had a number that was advertised in every directory in the 22nd District, and evidently it rang all weekend. When his secretary reached for it early Monday morning, she saw that there were over 20 calls and the mailbox was full. On an average weekend, there were half a dozen. 0 was not unusual. Over coffee, she and Lowell and the assistant DA, D.R. Musgrove, listened to the messages. Some of the callers gave their names and addresses. Others were more timid and seemed to think they were doing something wrong by calling the district attorney. A few hotheads used profanity, did not give their names, and implied that if the judicial system continued to go haywire, they just might have to fix it themselves. But it was unanimous. The kid was out of jail and pretending to be crazy, and his damned lawyer was once again pulling a fast one. "Please, Mr. Dyer, do something. Do your job." Lowell had never had a case that attracted so much interest, and he swung into action. He called Judge Noose, who was at home reading briefs, as he always claimed to be doing when he wasn't in court, and they agreed it was a good idea to call a special meeting of the grand jury to deal with the case. As the district attorney, Lowell controlled every aspect of his grand jury and needed no one's approval to call it into session. But given the sensational nature of the Gamble case, he wanted to keep the presiding judge apprised. During their brief conversation, Noose said something about a long weekend around his house, and Lowell suspected his phone had been ringing too. He sounded uncertain, even troubled, and when it was time for the conversation to end, Noose prolonged it by saying,
"Say, Lowell,
Let's go off the record here and talk in the graveyard. A pause, as if it was Lowell's turn to respond.
Sure, Judge.
Well, I'm having a devil of a time finding another lawyer to defend this boy. Nobody in the district wants the case. Pete Habershaw over in Oxford has 3 capital cases right now and just can't take on another. Rudy Thomas in Tupelo is undergoing chemo. I even had a chat with Joe Frank Jones in Jackson, and he gave me a flat no. I can't force the case on anyone outside of my jurisdiction, as you know. So all I could do was lean on these guys, and I got nowhere. You have any ideas? You know our lawyers well.
Lowell indeed knew them well, and wouldn't hire a single one of them if his neck were on the block. There were some fine lawyers in the district, but most avoided trial work, especially of the indigent criminal variety. To stall and divert, Lowell asked,
"Not sure, Judge. Who did the last capital case in the district?"
The last capital case in the 22nd had been 3 years earlier in Milburn County, in the town of Temple. The prosecutor had been Rufus Buckley, who was still smarting from his momentous loss in the Carl Lee Haley case. He won an easy verdict because the facts had been so horrible. A 20-year-old drug addict murdered both of his grandparents for $85 to buy more crack. He was now on death row at Parchman. Noose had presided and had not been impressed with the local defense lawyer he had dragged into the case.
"That won't work," he said. "That boy, what's his name, Gordy Wilson, wasn't very good, and I hear he's pretty much closed shop. Who would you hire, Lowell, if you were facing these charges? Who would you hire in the 22nd?
For obvious selfish reasons, Lowell wanted a pushover sitting at the defense table, but he knew that was unlikely.